Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The midterm elections are set for November 6th, and that's only around 7 weeks away. In Iowa's congressional districts, there's a lot of buzz around three Democratic candidates. Cynthia Axne is challenging David Young just south of here in District 3 in southwest Iowa. Abby Finkenauer is running for the 1st District in northeast Iowa against Rod Blum. And here in the 4th District, 38-year-old J.D. Shulton is challenging longtime Republican Congressman Steve King. Shulton is a native Sioux Cityan and a former professional baseball player. King has had a lock on the seat since 2003. Despite regularly making comments on issues like immigration that produce widespread backlash and concern, sometimes from his fellow Republicans, King has won his re-election bids by 27, 22, 32, 8, 23, and 22 percentage points, some very wide margins. However, as of last week, Steve King leads the Democratic challenger Shulton by just 6 points in a poll made available by Shulton's campaign. The poll was conducted by Washington, D.C.-based Expedition Strategies. It surveyed 380 likely voters from September 5th through the 9th. King received support from 43% of likely voters in the poll. Shulton was at 37%. Shulton says the poll and others like it are a sign his campaign is in striking distance of knocking off King in the heavily Republican district. In 2016, King defeated Democrat Kim Weaver by 22 points. The Democratic challenger also pointed to recent movements by political prognosticators as moving the race in his favor. However, King's son, Jeff King, who is an official on the campaign team, said an Emerson College poll, which showed that King had a lead of only 10 points, had a flawed methodology. Talking with Shulton over the last weekend, over the poll most recently released, Shulton said he was glad to see the campaign had ample room to grow.
Name recognition, anytime you have a first-time candidate like myself, that's one of the hardest things. But it's also one of the easiest things to fix with advertisements and whether it's on TV or newspapers or on the radio. And so we're going to really put forth an effort to get my name out there these last 2 months. And it also goes hand-in-hand with our what we're trying to do is we're going to be launching 39 counties, 39 town halls starting on Tuesday.
So it's a pretty ambitious campaign.
Yeah. I mean, we also call it the camp faking or camp fake showing up tour. And that's just been our big thing is getting out there to the people. And you look at the successful campaigns of the past on the Democratic side and the recent years haven't been too good, but, I look at two of my political heroes, which are Berkeley Bedell and Senator Harkin, and in 1984, they represented 80% of this district. And so what we've been doing this whole entire time is consistent with what we're going to do these last 51 days, and that's getting out there to the people, showing we're accessible, showing that we're going to prove that we're going to fight for the district and work hard for this district. And I think people are really responding to that.
Do you think part of it is partly that people might have some concerns with Steve King, especially in the past year, because of his many comments about immigration and, you know, issues that touch a lot of Iowans?
Absolutely. I think that has a lot to do with it. I constantly talk with folks like in Greene County last year at harvest time, so about this time last year. They needed 39 workers for the harvest, the grain elevator hit. And they didn't have one American citizen apply for it. And there's just a need to have a workforce in our 4th district. And I think that most folks understand that need. And as far as like the agriculture, what's going on now, especially with this trade war even before the trade war, there's a lot of anxiety going into this season. You have 4 consecutive years going into this season with low commodity prices, and farmers are frustrated, and rightfully so. And you got to look at to see who's fighting for the Iowa farmer. And King, I would say, has a pretty low standard on that.
Do you think that this district and will be considered more of a possible swing district if your numbers keep improving? It seems like the first district, I don't know if that's the Rod Blum district, one with Abby Finkenauer?
Well, that's right. The first district's with Abby Finkenauer and Rod Blum. I don't see this race stopping now. I mean, we went from last year, when we started the campaign, we were at about 22 points down, because that's what he won pretty much the last two elections by. And then earlier this week, there was a national poll that said we were 10 behind, but he is only polling at 41%. And that's pretty consistent with what our poll showed, that he was polling at 43% in our poll. And then in December, Ann Seltzer with the Des Moines Register had a poll that just generically, would you vote for a Republican or a Democrat in the 4th Congressional District? And it was 39% Republican, 36% Democrat, and 14% undecided. And so there's a lot of undecided folks. And when you are an eight-time incumbent and there's that many people undecided, I don't see things going in his favor too often from here on out, because for the most part, they've had a lot of opportunity to know who he is, and they're still learning about us.
I know that you have been asking Steve King to engage in at least three debates.
Crickets. So I don't know if that means we offered three debates or a free throw contest. So I don't know if that means we're going to be doing a free throw contest or not. I thought the Sioux City Journal today, the editorial board had a nice article that said the people deserve to hear a debate between King and myself. And I think that's very accurate, especially with all the polling and everything. And his response at the Clay County Fair was that there's no clear division of issues. And I could give a pretty quick list of the issues that we are different, we feel differently.
I know immigration has been one of the issues that you've been running on. What are the other big issues for you?
Yeah, healthcare is the number one issue, and it's been the number one issue since we launched the campaign. When I go into, I drive around, and I'm currently on our used Winnebago that we named Sioux City Sioux, and what we're every time I fill this thing up, there's usually a donation box that is meant for someone who just got sick or that just had an accident. And we're the wealthiest country in the world, and yet we can't. That's how we allow some of our people to pay for health insurance and health care. And that's just, we need to find better solutions to that. We talk about the economy, and you hear a lot about how good Wall Street's doing. Well, the reality is that 60% of Americans can't handle a $500 emergency. And what we're seeing in the 4th District is, I just had my high school 20th reunion, and the kids I graduated with are doing great things, whether they went straight into the workforce or they went into college first, but they're not doing it in Sioux City. Not a lot of them are. Some are, but the majority of them moved away. And I want to build an economy and modernize our economy that can allow our kids and my classmates to stay and raise their families in the 4th District. And right now, that's not the case. And the third thing I talk all the time about is cleaning up Washington. And I feel there's far too much special interest out there. And that's why my campaign has proudly took a pledge to not take any money from corporate PACs. And that goes hand in hand with our message. And we've been able to outraise King this entire election cycle, even without taking corporate PACs.
I mean, obviously, if you were to win this seat, that would be really a huge win for Democrats here, but nationally as well. And that must really be in the back of your mind all the time.
It's really not. I'm focused on just this race and what we can do to prevail. I really don't think of this as a national race. And to be honest, like, I'm not running against Steve King. I'm running for the people of this district. And there's so many people that are just frustrated with the lack of representation. I hear this all the time that people, I went to D.C. to meet with him, but he didn't meet with my group. And you see that he hasn't gone to 39% of the conference hearings with the Agriculture Conference Committee, and then you also see with the Small Business Conference Committee, he's missed 82%, and these are numbers from the last decade. And it's just, you start getting frustrated with your representative who's not doing public events, not doing town halls where he looks people in the eye, and now he's not debating. It's just, what's a representative supposed to be? And that's a huge frustration of ours.
So what's your game plan in the run-up to the election?
Our big thing going from here to the November is continue with what we have been doing. And I think that's the success of our campaign. That's getting out there to the people. And it all starts with the 39-county, 39-town hall. And this will be the third time doing all 39 counties. I did it in my personal vehicle, put 35,000 miles on that. Then we bought the Winnebago RV. And we've done a tour of that, and now we'll be doing it for a third time. And I think that's the key to our success, is just showing how accessible we are. And I've made a pledge that when we win in November, I'll do this every year that I'm elected, to get out there and see the people, because that's what a representative should be. This district deserves to have a discussion about who our leader should be.
That was Democratic 4th District candidate J.D. Scholten, who's taking on veteran Republican incumbent Steve King in this fall's midterm elections. Next week, we'll talk with Steve King about his campaign, and he'll answer some of the allegations made about him and his campaign by the Scholten campaign. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, Woodbury County is preparing for the midterm elections, realizing it needs new voting machines, although they won't arrive in time for November 6th. The Woodbury County Board of Supervisors approved the purchase of a new collection of optical scan voting machines, costing nearly $380,000. They will replace machines that are more than a dozen years old. Yesterday, the board approved a plan described by Auditor Pat Gill, the county's chief elections official, to spend $375,000 and change for 46 machines, and that will be enough to cover the 44 county voting precincts in Sioux City and more rural areas, plus two extras for future or backup needs. Gill said the new machines are more technologically advanced, and the current ones have an expected life of 10 years and have recently been bulky. Gill told the board last night he had hoped the county could use the voting center system for elections, which requires fewer voting locations and equipment.
I put off purchasing the equipment because I've been trying to work with the Secretary of State's office, and they actually in favor of the proposal to use vote centers in general elections and primary elections, but the legislature hasn't seen fit to pass that. So we have to stay with the 44 county or precincts that we have in Woodbury County. So that forces us to buy more equipment than what we really wanted to.
The machines should arrive by December, so they won't be used in the November midterm elections. They will be on hand in 2019 for use in Sioux City School Board and Sioux City Council elections. In 2005, the county spent $550,000 to buy 50 optical scan voting machines and 45 voter assist terminals and software. Most of that funding came through the federal Help America Vote Act, which sought to modernize voting machines across the country. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Now that the school year is well underway, the specter of bullying is once again an issue. Research shows that bullying has effectively moved on beyond the schoolyard to social media and can be very damaging for the bullied and the bullier. A new study by the nonprofit CNA Education Research Organization takes a look at the most effective support practices to support the victims of bullying. I talk with Simone Robars, who is the author of the study, about the various forms of bullying and about what schools, parents, and kids can do to try and stop it.
So there's physical bullying, which takes the form of like possibly fighting or destroying someone's property. And then there's the emotional, social, passive-aggressive type of bullying. So that would be name-calling, insulting someone, spreading rumors about someone, or excluding someone from activities on purpose.
And a lot of that second kind seems to happen among young girls, it seems.
That is also correct. So statistically speaking, the passive-aggressive, non-verbal, I will say, type of bullying is more prominent among girls, while the physical-aggressive behavior is more prominent among boys. I will also add that now that we have the platform of social media, the cyberbullying is percentage of girls that report being the victim of cyberbullying is higher compared to boys also.
I know that schools do a lot of work in trying to prevent bullying. What are some of the more effective ways to try and prevent bullying?
Sure. So bullying has always existed, and there are many anti-bullying programs that are available nowadays for schools to implement. Our research at CNA Education has identified two key points. The first one being that ineffective programs are one-off programs, so programs that might occur once during the school year, possibly right now at the beginning of the school year. Effective programs are holistic programs that are built into the school curriculum on a continuous basis throughout the school year, and they stress a social emotional approach. So they teach that silence allows bullying to thrive. They teach resiliency for students. So that might take the form of role play or acting out scenarios within the school setting. They invite external partners in, so the parents or other adults in the children's lives, and they include the whole school system. So then they don't target necessarily one grade at a time, but rather bring all the grades together at the same time.
So as a parent, you try and prevent your child from bullying others, and you don't want your child to be bullied either. Sometimes it's hard to know. Sometimes it's a surprise that your child has been, you know, seen by some others as being a bully. I mean, that's a tough situation. I think that's almost as tough as being a parent of a child who's being bullied.
Absolutely. I fully agree with that. So effective resiliency building programs stress positive behavior, empathy, social connectedness, and relatability. So early on, what parents and teachers can do is have conversations with your children about what bullying might look like, what forms bullying and cyberbullying can take, so they get help in identifying when they are the victim of bullying or might be more aware that they are actually being a perpetrator of bullying. We have to encourage our children to have those conversations with their peers and other adults as well. Very helpful is to tell stories of when you might have been the victim of bullying, how that made you feel, and what actions you took or did not take and wish you had taken. We want to ask questions, like ask our children who they play with and what they play. It's pay attention behind the scenes. So an example that I can share is that over the summer, my daughter played with a girl for weeks at a time at summer camp. And after a few weeks, she stopped mentioning this girl's name, which raised a flag for me. So I asked questions about who she's playing with, what's going on. And it turned out that this girl was, in fact, calling her names on the playground. So she turned away from that situation, essentially told her, "You're being a bully. I'm not going to play with you." And walked away from the situation, then told me about it. I asked her if she wanted me to take further steps or measures. She did not want me to, and I respected that. The situation resolved itself, but of course we're talking about early elementary in this case, and it becomes more difficult as children get older.
And so the kids standing around and also, you know, teachers or people that are other parents, I mean, I guess we think of them as bystanders, but you say bystanders can really make a difference in this.
Absolutely. A bystander makes a big difference. So the most effective anti-bullying programs actually take the holistic approach that teaches situations in which kids are exposed to bullying situations. So that can be maybe an online game where children have to make choices as to whether they would speak up, what they might say, or they are active scenarios that are played out in the school setting. But again, it's holistic. So it invites parents in, it invites researchers in, counselors can conduct observations. We at CNA Education conduct surveys and focus groups, and we also conduct observations, and those might show triggers or expose individuals that say certain things, and then we as external research partners can inform the school about what's going on within their school and then help them implement most effective programs.
But you also say, you know, victims can actually adjust and thrive even when they're in a stressful environment. And I think that is really good news, especially for kids and teens who feel they're being bullied.
Yes, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I've been the victim of bullying myself, and I think I turned out all right, but I mainly turned out all right because I had a trusted adult that I could turn to. So I really think it's crucial to make sure that these trusted adults are in the environment of our children. And again, that doesn't have to necessarily be the parent or the teacher. That can be a close family friend, or it can be an aunt or uncle. So we really need to make sure that we have those conversations early on and help our kids identify when they are being victimized.
How do schools know and other organizations know that they're having an effect with these anti-bullying programs? How do they know that they're working?
So that is evaluation research, which is what we do at CNA Education. So we collaborate with the schools and the districts to look at the programs they have implemented and assess their effectiveness via surveys and focus groups and observations.
What I find interesting, too, is sometimes all it will take is one student, one other child who the other students respect, who will refuse to take part in the bullying. And that will turn things around. But, you know, that's something that one cannot necessarily predict or make it happen.
Yes, that is correct. Sometimes it really only just takes one child to not be a bystander. That can make all the difference, and it is very difficult to get our children not to feel that they might make themselves vulnerable if they do speak up. So the key to all of this is to reinforce the point that all of this needs to start much earlier. Bullying programs are very focused on middle school, and we really need to make sure that we implement this early as kindergarten.
That was Simone Robars with the nonprofit CNA Education Research Organization. She's the author of a new study on practices to help victims of bullying. She's based in Arlington, Virginia. Next week, we hope to talk with the superintendent of the Sioux City Community School District, Paul Gosman, about its bullying practices. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Journalist and author Bill Zarin is a native of Lakeview, Iowa, and when you read his books, you can tell he's never forgotten that. His new book is based in Okoboji. It's the fourth in his series of mystery books based on the adventures of Sioux City prosecutor Hillary Reed and Sioux City Sentinel reporter Tom Kingman. The two have progressed from a professional friendship to a romance, and they're in Hillary's hometown to meet the family. Tom says the couple once again are presented with a crime.
And so that's kind of what gets them up to the Okoboji area. And then, of course, Tom and Hillary always seem to find trouble, so they find some in Okoboji.
Going through the book, I won't give away too much, but there ends up being a murder at the Tipsy House, which is the Tipsy House is the name of the book.
And the story was really inspired by back in the late 90s when the park was sold and there was a plan to redevelop it, and a bunch of people rallied around to save the park and donated to the a fund that bought it back from the developer. I actually donated to that fund. And so in real life, it was much different, and the developer sold it back, and he wasn't evil or anything like that. But in the book, the developer gets killed. In the Tipsy House, somebody murders him. So we got to figure out who did it.
It's such an iconic place for most of us who've been up there. I refuse to go in there now because it makes me feel sick. But the kids love it, for sure.
Yeah, actually, I just love the name Tipsy House, first of all. And second of all, I know it well because I grew up in Lake Park, which is, as you know, it's 15 miles from Arnold's Park where the Tipsy House is. And yeah, I'm with you. I can't go in there. I'm a little bit too old. I went in there to scout it for the book a couple of years ago, and I went through it a few times, and I'm going to fall down and break a hip if I go in there too much.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, you talk about scouting locations for your books. Do you have it in your mind pretty much, though, like when you have this idea to have this particular plot generally where you want to put it, then you go out and look for places? Is that how you do it?
Yeah, I usually come up with where it's going to be. And so far they've been in Sioux City, one was in Council Bluffs, and one was in Okoboji. So I wanted to write a book about Okoboji because I'm from Lake Park. My parents still live there, so I get up there a lot. And I just wanted to set it in Okoboji. And then I thought, well, you know, what kind of plot can we have? And then I got the idea of being inspired by the park sale, you know, 20 years ago, and kind of went from there.
Well, the character in the book, Tom, he's a reporter for a Sioux City paper. You were a reporter for the Sioux City Journal. Did you cover crime when you were at the Journal? Did you get some ideas about what you want to write about from that?
Yeah, I covered everything. I did crime and courts, and features were my main beats. So crime and courts put together is what kind of spawned the idea for the whole series and the two characters. Tom is kind of, I tell people Tom is the reporter I wish I was or had been. He's very bold and brash and doesn't care what people think and charges in. And Hillary is sort of a combination of a bunch of attorneys, both prosecutors and defenders that I dealt with or observed when I was in the newspaper. There was a lot of good female assistant county attorneys that bits of them are in Hillary as well.
I was wondering how difficult it was for you to go from being a journalist. A lot of us journalists think, I know I have a book in me. I know I have a book to write, and I can do that. But what's it like to actually do it?
I always wanted to write a novel. I didn't necessarily think it had to be published for me to accomplish that goal. And I did accomplish the goal back in the 90s, but it just wasn't published right away. It's cool to actually have the manuscript done and have it to a point where you think it's the best you can do. So that was a good feeling. And then when I first got the first, what's called the printer proof, which is basically the first copy of the paperback that we look over to make sure everything's okay, then, I mean, that was quite a moment. I had to take a little moment when I got, so that was very cool because, you know, you just like, that seems to be the ultimate for a lot of writers, is for me to write the great American novel.
Is it hard in today's, you know, book selling worlds? A lot of people read books. I know I do online, and I know, well, this book, and are your other books online as well? Are you sort of into that market?
Well, Kindle is pretty much the big market for a lot of authors, and it's good and bad. It's mostly good, I think. It lets people, cuts down a lot of the costs involved, you know, and there's no paper, there's no printing. And a lot of Kindle books have free samples, so you can just download, I don't know, a chapter or two and try it out. And then if you like it, you can buy from there. So I do that a lot.
Yeah, I think it's really kind of helpful to selling books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And plus they're like, my books are $2.99 for Kindle books, and that's a lot more affordable for people. And I mean, the way that the royalty structure works, I actually make more money for a Kindle book sell than I do for a paperback. So I'm not mad at all if people buy Kindle book versions.
Now, your next book is set in Woodbury County.
That's right, rural Woodbury County by Smithland, which is, well, as you know, it's down in the south. I'm used to telling people here about Woodbury County. I'm in Des Moines, so they don't know. But it's down in the southeast corner of the county.
You know, that part of the county doesn't get a lot of attention, so it's kind of nice to have a book set there.
Yeah, I picked it because I wanted it to be in the Lush Hills, and I also wanted it to be as far away from the city as possible for a couple plot reasons. And so I went out there, actually, and I scouted again, and I drove through that part of the county, which I hadn't been to for a long time. A lot of people in Sioux City never even don't know anything about it out there. So it's very, you know, it's scenic, and there's little rolling hills, and really used that setting to build my plot around, and it came out pretty well. It's in the edit process now, and I hope next year this time it'll be out.
If you've got this series of books, so do you have in mind writing other things?
No, I thought about maybe spinning off a character from Tipsy House, maybe the sheriff or something, I don't know. But I think that I just want to stick with Tom and Hillary. But I love mystery series myself, so I just want to go with that and maybe squeeze 10 books out of it and call it good.
Just personally, it's nice to see a journalist making this work. I know it's a lot of work.
Yeah, and you're never going to quit your day job.
Yeah.
Only the biggest, like Grisham-level authors can do that, but most of us, even if we are Random House published authors, they got a side gig to keep them going. So if you think you get into writing books to make a living from it, you're probably going to get a pretty rude awakening. But if for me, it's recreation, and it's kind of a nice literary exercise.
That was Bill Zarin, the author of Tipsy House, the fourth in his series of mysteries with Sioux City prosecutor Hillary Reed and journalist Tom Kingman. Zarin is now working on a book set in rural Woodbury County. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Sioux City Arts Center holds many treasures. One of them, tucked away upstairs in the H.H. Everest Gallery on the third floor, is the Corn Room Mural. It's one of four murals commissioned by an Omaha businessman named Eugene Epley for his hotels in Council Bluffs, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, and Sioux City. It was originally part of the historic Martin Hotel. The Corn Room was created by Grant Wood in 1926. It was lost for decades under paint and old wallpaper and rediscovered in 1979. I talked with the Art Center's Todd Behrens about the artist Grant Wood and how Eugene Epley acquired hotels and then commissioned murals to decorate them.
He purchased one in Cedar Rapids, in Council Bluffs, and in Sioux City. And in Sioux City, the one he bought was the Martin Hotel, which is at the corner of 4th and Pierce. The building, of course, still exists. In the fall of 1925, he decided to hire Grant Wood and one of Wood's assistants to paint a mural in the dining room of the Cedar Rapids Hotel that he had purchased. And so Grant Wood decorated the room. It included chandeliers that had ears of corn as the candle holders, and a mural that pretty much filled the wall space, showing a field of corn. And above that were even some of the lyrics to the Iowa corn song that had been written not too long before that. In 1926, Epley decided to do the same thing in Sioux City and then in Council Bluffs. And so Grant Wood and his assistant came here in 26 and finished it, I think, in the fall, early fall of 1926. What we have is what remains of that. This was, of course, over 90 years ago, and the hotel has changed hands a number of times. And during those times, tastes changed. And so the love of the corn field was not aging well in the 1950s when the Sheraton Corporation bought the hotel. They covered over it, and it was uncovered again sometime around 1980. And so it was a long process, literally a couple of decades, to go from finding the mural, trying to work with the owners of the building, who were in the process of changing hands, and working with conservators to see what they could do to extract and protect the painting. And so we have 7 panels of various sizes, representing a good portion of what had been on display in the dining room up at the Martin Hotel. It's yellowed now because of the damage through the wallpapering and also through Grant Wood's painting techniques, where he would paint onto the surface and then scrape off at the same time. So it was kind of a rough way of painting.
And, you know, this really doesn't look so much like a Grant Wood painting, the kind of Grant Wood painting that I'm used to seeing.
What might be a little surprising to people when they come and see the Corn Room is that it doesn't look like the same artist as who made American Gothic. Where he became known from that painting and then the paintings he did for the rest of his life was his very clean, clear way of painting, a very precise way of painting that he learned just after he finished his Corn Rooms. He traveled to Germany and studied with some of the great artists who were working in Germany in the late 1920s who had this kind of style, and he brought that back with him and then went on to the acclaim that we all know about. In 1926, he was working in something more like Impressionism. It's a little hard to see given the condition of the Corn Room, but you can see a little bit of it. There was a more of a brushy quality to it, not going for making the ears of corn and the barns and things like that rendered precisely. It was more of a lighter touch.
We often talk about Grant Wood as a regionalist. Does this portray him as a regionalist? Or does this represent him as a regionalist, do you think?
In some ways, technically speaking, this wouldn't be regionalism, but because that was sort of a moment in the 1930s when art and literature kind of came together to promote certain parts of the rural America. But clearly this has all of the antecedents of that. He was at the time this was a commission piece, and that's what he was working on, like many artists would. But he had a deep fondness for Iowa that came out. If you've ever been to Cedar Rapids and you've seen their more extensive collection of his work, particularly from the 1920s, you can see that he had a love of the landscape of Iowa, and you can see that in this as well. I'm sure that it was one part, it was a job, it was a buck, but it was also something that he really loved to do, especially since he got to, as I said before, kind of control this entire massive public space in the hotel.
There's a lot about Grant Wood that most of us don't know. I was reading about him and how he was involved in Depression era projects, and he was in charge of an art program in Iowa City. He played many different roles in his life.
Yeah, and he, as I mentioned, he really didn't come to a great stature in the art world until 1930, and he unfortunately died very young. He died in the early 1940s, so his mature career, in a way, only lasted a little over a decade. But in that time, he made just a beautiful array of paintings. He became a storyteller. Some of his paintings are pure landscape, but many of them are narrative and are really whimsical, humorous, sometimes bitingly humorous. And the landscapes can just be beautiful. But you're right, he was a prolific artist in the WPA era, doing projects. He did a huge number of prints. And this was an era because it was the Depression, people didn't have a lot of money. Prints were a great way to help make sure that everybody had access to art. And so he was very helpful in that regard. And we have a number of those prints in our collection as well. And then he went on to head the art department at the University of Iowa for a period of time. So it was this really dramatic shift from the first 39 years of being a struggling artist, in a sense, to becoming quite a successful man.
The prints of his paintings of the rolling hills of eastern Iowa and the hills almost looking like it was a woodcut, and just so precise, that style of painting.
Thinking of that, when I was, I'm an East Coaster for most of my life, and I was home recently, and everybody I talk to when I talk about Iowa, they mention how flat it must be because they think it's part of the plains, and I have to correct them. And it's like, look at the paintings of Grant Wood, because even though they are, they're playful and stylized, there's something realistic about them. Though he captures the rolling hills that dominate Iowa's landscape so perfectly. I don't know, I was amazed when I first flew here to come and check out the art center for a job, and that I was looking at Grant Wood's landscapes as I was flying over the state.
You know, Grant Wood is an artist that seems very accessible to people, and a lot of people are sort of afraid of art, not afraid of the art, but afraid of looking stupid around art. And I think people don't feel like they don't know what they're looking at when they look at a Grant Wood piece.
Yeah, you know, the 1930s, when Grant Wood was one of, if not the most famous and beloved artists in the United States, was a time when I think because it was such a struggle for so many people, the art that was produced to a large extent was something that was simple in a way. Now, that's not to say that his compositions are simple or his talent was in any way simple, but it was something that had a universal quality to it, and that was something that was really, really needed. As the U.S. came out of the Depression, and started to head into World War II and beyond, his style, in terms of the art world, became very quickly discarded. And that's a shame. You know, the other artists that he had teamed up with, in a sense, the regionalist artists, they continued to work longer than Wood's life and maintained that style. And and they produced wonderful artworks. But it's... You know, it's that art always has to seem to progress, you know, to wherever we are now is not where we want to be in the near future with so many in the art world. And so there are times when artists can get kind of trampled on as time moves. But the thing that's clear is that Grant Wood is so enduring. I was so happy earlier this year the Whitney Museum put on a major exhibition of his work. It's the first time in a little while that one of the modern art museums in New York had brought Grant Wood to the fore. But it was a huge exhibition. They've done a lot more research and helped to make sure that everybody now in the 21st century is aware of one of America's greatest 20th century artists.
If someone wanted to find out more or learn more about Grant Wood, would you recommend a certain place in Iowa or a place online? Or
because he spent so much of his life in Cedar Rapids, while we're very proud of the Corn Room mural that we have, they have a more extensive collection and can give Iowans a broader sense of his artistic gifts. If they're interested in more information, I haven't actually checked it out yet. I've just seen excerpts, but the Whitney Museum did produce an extensive book with new essays on different parts of Grant Wood's life and art, bringing a lot more attention to some of the personal aspects of his life that were within his paintings that we might not have otherwise been aware of.
That was Todd Behrens of the Sioux City Art Center talking about the Corn Mural, a 7-panel work by Grant Wood that's on permanent display at the Art Center. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. You can step into the Renaissance with full armored jousting, birds of prey, knights and princesses, and so much more at this year's Rivercade Riversance at the Riverside Park on October 6th and 7th. I talked with Riversance organizers Phil Clayes and Gary Lewis about the festival.
We have another wonderful, wonderful, wonderful year planned with many events. It's totally family orientated. Kids love it of all ages. And one thing I'm going to start off with right now, there's been this misconception for years that you have to be in costume to come to the Renaissance Festival. And that's not true. You can if you wish to come in costume, but other than that, there's hundreds of us out there that are there in costume just to entertain you when you visit our kingdom. So please feel free to come without being in costume. In fact, we welcome that to come visit our kingdom of Riversance, October 6th and 7th at Riverside Park.
In fact, don't we have some kind of a special deal if people do show up in costume?
Oh, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Okay. Sometimes. It's a dilly-dilly thing, you know. We've been known to let people in free when they came in full costume.
That's what I was
full costume. And that's the thing, it has to be full costume.
And we say come out dressed as Vikings. We're not talking purple and gold with horns on your hat, you know. We're talking about Viking garb.
Yes. We do invite children to come, of course, because it's you know, the month of October and Halloween. We do invite children to come in their costumes from their Halloween. They could pre-see how they look in that and come out and have fun. Because what we've done, you know, my brother Larry and I started this with Rivercade 16 years ago, and the idea was to set a playground in motion. And the playground is the Riverside Park, the area that we use. And we're having a harvest festival, Rivercade Harvest Festival, with a Renaissance theme. So we're shooting for the 15th, 16th centuries of Old England. We have full armored jousting. We have birds of prey. We have wenches. We have kings and queens and pirates and Vikings and gypsies and fairies of the forest. And we just have it all.
Phil, why do you think Riversance has been so successful?
I think it's that we see it as a family gathering. Rivercade being a nonprofit, we don't approach it as a business. And that just takes an edge off. And everybody comments about that, that goes to the other festivals and works the other festivals. With us, you know, when people get there, we greet them with a hug, you know, and it's like, hey, welcome back for the family reunion this year, you know, family gathering. And it's just that kind of a karmically approached event. As an example, there's only one basic rule, and that's that everybody have fun and harm no one. And the other theme of our character, our group of characters, is that there are no problems in the kingdom of Riversance. There's only solutions. So if you simplify it that way and just say, hey, come on out, this is your playground, have fun, be safe, it just kind of sets a thing where it's everybody's favorite Renaissance festival. And that's what we had hoped to accomplish, and that's what we have accomplished. But there's all kinds of artisans, there's all kinds of musicians, there's all kinds of comedic players. And as I say, the full armored joust three times each day. The Dance of Fire at 8:15 each on Saturday night is a really fun event. And there's just all these fun things going on. I mean, you walk in and there's all these things that are just saying, hey, enjoy. And that's what we have created.
That was Phil Clayes and Gary Lewis talking about this year's Rivercade Riversance Festival at Riverside Park, October 6th and 7th. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.